Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. Hi, everybody. I'm Stesha Brandon. I'm the Literature and Humanities Program Manager here at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to this evening's event with Xiaoqing Chao, presented in partnership with Elliott Bay Book Company and Sasquatch Books. Thank you to our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support of library programs. Finally, we are grateful to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation from thousands of donors help the library provide free programs and services that touch the lives of everyone in our community. So if any of you are Library Foundation donors here with us tonight, thank you so much for your support. Now I am delighted to introduce Xiaoqing Chao. Xiaoqing is the former food editor at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper, and that's actually how we first met back in the day. I think that was a good, 10 years ago, maybe? 15? 18 years ago. It was like yesterday. Anyway. Xiaoqing has appeared on national television and radio, including Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations and on my favorite, The Splendid Table. She's won the coveted Burt Green Award for the International Association for Culinary Professionals for Excellence in Feature Writing, and she has started a public relations firm that focused on restaurants, including clients from some of the fanciest and best restaurants here in Seattle, including Tilth, Matt's in the Market, Canlis, and Pagliacci Pizza. That was back in 2007 she started that firm, and then for several years, until 2017, she was the director of communications at the Institute for Systems Biology, a nonprofit biomedical research association. As if that is not enough, she keeps one foot in the food world as an instructor at Hot Stove Society, which is Chef Tom Douglas's cooking school at the Hotel Andra. She's also a member of the James Beard Foundation's Cookbook Committee and also a member of La Dame's Escoffier Seattle, and also volunteers on the Communications Committee for FairStart.org. What have you guys done today? I don't know. Anyway, without further ado, please help me welcome Xiaoqing Chao here to talk about her new book, Chinese Soul Food.
Thank you guys so much for coming. I'm going to read a little bit from the book today, and then I've selected a few pieces, and if we have some time, I have an essay that is not in the book but is about the book that I would like to read as well. So let's start from the beginning, because apparently that's a very good place to start, according to Julie Andrews. And I wanted to read the foreword to you because I invited my mother to write the foreword, and it's, you know, just to give her a piece of this book and a voice, because she has a very strong voice. She's a writer herself, and all of these stories in this cookbook come from family stories, and so we wanted to give her a piece of that. So this is from the foreword. In The Primrose Path in 1936, Ogden Nash writes, "Her picture's in the papers now, and life's a piece of cake." While reading my daughter Xiaoqing's cookbook, I thought about this quote because her message, ultimately, is that cooking Chinese food in a Western kitchen is not as hard as it may seem. Most Chinese people go into their kitchens without ever consulting a cookbook. I don't. My mother certainly didn't. The very first dish I ever cooked for myself was a bowl of rice noodle soup with daikon radish strips and a few pieces of dried shrimp for flavor. It was only because my mother was not home that day that I had to feed myself. The kitchen was normally off limits to me. The wok was there, the stove was there, but my mother never let me touch them. Her biggest regret was that her circumstances prevented her from attending school. So her dream was for me to complete my formal education. She didn't want me wasting my time in the kitchen. So even though I had no ambition for becoming an academic, I reached graduate school and earned a master's degree from the University of Missouri School of Journalism for her. My father was a military man with a limited income. Luckily, our family received a small stipend for military dependents that helped. I was born during the Sino-Japanese War, and I didn't even have a single photo to prove my existence. Thus, my character was built on the value of not asking for too much in life and appreciating whatever I may receive. After I fulfilled my mother's dream, I married a man I'd met in college. We both had steady jobs and fair incomes, so we started a family and had Xiaoqing first, then her brother, Shihong. Then, when my husband decided to pursue his master's degree, also at the University of Missouri, we set forth on our future life in the United States. With my husband in school and two young children in tow, I eventually gave up my career as a journalist. That was when I started taking cooking more seriously. We were in a campus apartment with some hand-me-down cookware, but no wok. But I tried every way to feed my family, including making dumpling skins with a sawed-off broomstick as a rolling pin. And it was blue, by the way. Our third child, David Jr., was born at University Hospital near campus. The only cookbook I always had was my memory of good eating. So I joked that I was an impressionist cook. It wasn't until we opened a small carryout restaurant that I even bought a Chinese cookbook to double-check some details related to technique. Xiaoqing explains that the purpose of this book is to encourage people to get into the kitchen and start cooking. That's what we did, and so can you. I am mostly touched by the fond family memories she has brought back with her stories. A warm kitchen is the heart of the family, and that is sweeter than cake. So my mother wrote that. I said, you know, I really want you to write the foreword to this. And I gave her the manuscript, and she read it and wrote this piece. And it's in Mandarin in the front of the book. And I said, you write it in Mandarin, because she's such a good writer in Chinese. And I said, I'll help you with the translation. But not only did she write it in Chinese, she wrote the translation as well. And I had only to refine some of the transitions. So it was just so great that she took this with such enthusiasm. And she's sitting right here in purple in the gray hat. So she's here. She was a journalist back in the 60s in Taipei, so if you can imagine a female journalist at that time and in Asia, I mean, that's pretty incredible achievement. All right, so I'm going to read from the introduction just to kind of set the scene a little bit. Growing up in my family's Chinese restaurant and then becoming a professional food writer did not give me license to write a cookbook. I had the ingredients, so to speak, an immigrant story, restaurant credibility, a journalism degree, a food column in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper, a fan base, an agent, even polite interest from a couple of New York publishers. But I had nothing to say. It wasn't until after I had gotten married, had two children, quit the newspaper, and changed career paths a couple of times that the cookbook declared to me its need to exist. Life had taken me on the scenic route toward this end, and it began with the Chinese Soul Food blog in 2007, which I had started in hopes of maintaining my weekly practice of writing and providing a hub for my fans. I also wanted to create a space to share straightforward but comforting recipes inspired by foods I ate growing up. The ingredients wouldn't break the bank, and the recipes could be made possibly with a small child literally wrapped around your leg or while wearing a baby in a sling. That scenario was a reality for me at the time. Money was tight too, so I had to be resourceful about ingredients. I knew that the Chinese cooking I had grown up eating could be extremely economical. Considering many stir fries are vegetable centric with meat only as a condiment. I figured if I needed such a resource, There probably were other parents out there in the same boat. Despite a good start, the blog suffered from neglect, especially after I had a second child. So it went dormant until about 2015, when the opportunity to teach regular classes on Chinese cooking at Hot Stove Society, an avocational cooking school in Seattle, revived my need for a recipe blog. When I was at the newspaper, my column was a weekly trigger for home cooks to reach out to me with questions or comments about recipes of all types. I learned as much from the readers as they learned from me. After I left the paper, that channel of exchange became non-existent. It took 5 or so years away from the day-to-day of journalism to give me the perspective I needed to understand what I had missed about being a columnist. Telling universal stories through the lens of cooking, eating, and thinking about food, and, more importantly, being in a position to convey cooking skills to a broad audience in order to empower them to feed themselves and their families deliciously, simply, and wholesomely. I knew I needed to return to the food community in some way to regain that connection with home cooks. Through monthly cooking classes on how to make pot stickers, soup dumplings, and simple stir fries, the path back into the conversation opened up again. My ultimate goal is to get you into the kitchen. Chinese cooking can be daunting because the ingredients and methods are unfamiliar, and if you haven't experienced the diversity of regional Chinese dishes, your palate may not have a baseline for the flavor profiles. The complaints I hear most often about why people don't cook Chinese food are that the ingredients seem too, quote, exotic, and that cutting all the ingredients is so much work. The most common aha I hear after students attend a class, however, is that a given dish wasn't as hard to cook as they thought. Even one of my chef colleagues at the cooking school commented that she was surprised at how accessible and delicious many of my recipes are. I think our brains are wired to associate long lists of ingredients with a higher degree of difficulty, causing us to see a greater challenge than exists. I make it a point to remind all the home cooks I meet to have a growth mindset. You will likely have some mess-ups to start, and that's okay. You will improve only if you first develop a habit of cooking Chinese dishes. When you internalize some of the basic principles, you will be able to improvise based on what's available. Chinese cooks in general don't start with a recipe or menu. They're more likely to let the ingredients on hand and any leftovers to determine what they cook. They are more concerned with balancing the components and flavors of a meal than following a particular recipe. Perhaps your journey starts with cooking a Chinese meal once a week and building from there. Don't fret about not having the exact equipment or the full complement of specialty ingredients. Yes, having the appropriate equipment in general makes it easier to cook, but ultimately, Chinese home cooking is about being resourceful and adaptable. Any kitchen can be a Chinese kitchen. When my parents first arrived in Columbia, Missouri in 1975 with two young children and a few suitcases, there were no Asian markets. They had to shop at IGA, Chinooks, and Kroger, where they couldn't even find Napa cabbage or any other familiar ingredients. They had to drive 10 hours north to Chicago to stock up on good soy sauce. We had secondhand cookware and a humble food budget. We lived in a tiny apartment in a university-owned complex for graduate and married students. And yet, my parents cooked Chinese meals every day. It's this food that sustained me in those early formative years. I have clear memories of being 4 or 5 years old, standing on my toes trying to watch my mother make dumplings, of slurping 2 hot chicken soup with ginger and shiitakes while sitting at our white metal dinner table, of eating bowls of rice topped with red braised pork, of the very special occasions when my father would splurge for frozen Alaskan snow crab to stir fry with green onions, ginger, garlic. I also can hear the dull sound of the wooden chopsticks tapping the bottom of the small aluminum pot that my parents used to make rice, soup, and even the Kung Fu brand instant noodles that to this day I will eat on occasion. By the time my parents opened a restaurant in 1980, it was easier to get Asian ingredients in Colombia. There were specialty wholesalers in St. Louis that would send their trucks an hour and a half to our town to deliver us and other Chinese restaurants. Having access to authentic ingredients did not mitigate our customers' demands for deep-fried sweet and sour pork, cream cheese wontons, chop suey, cashew chicken, and the like. They wanted cheap and fast Chinese food that satisfied their sweet tooth. During the 23 years the restaurant operated, the turning point came in the mid-1990s when my parents pivoted from full-service dining to a buffet restaurant. Business increased substantially, which certainly benefited the family. But while much of the menu reflected Americanized dishes, we billed ourselves as a home-styled Sichuanese restaurant. We offered classic dishes such as mapo tofu, dried fried green beans, fresh fish fragrant, eggplant, kung pao chicken, and twice-cooked pork. These were far from bestsellers, but they were dishes my parents liked that reminded them of home. Neither of them were born in the Sichuan province in China, however. Their palates were shaped by war. My mother's family was from the north in Manchuria, and my father's family was from Henan in central China. Because my grandfathers were both officers in the Kuomintang National Army, they and their families retreated to Taiwan when the communists took over in 1949. All the mainlander military families settled in what initially were meant to be provisional villages throughout the island. The culinary result of this displacement of people from diverse regions across China, who now were surrounded by Taiwanese culture, was a delicious intersection of influences on home cooking. This thread carried through to our family's restaurant. The Chinese name my parents coined for the restaurant translates roughly to homeland cooking or homestyle eats. Similarly, the Chinese name for this cookbook loosely translates to everyone's kitchen. The spirit of the name connects to the heart of the cooking in this book, which is grounded in this legacy of intertwined regional traditions and resourcefulness. I can take small liberties to accommodate taste preferences or apply refinements to the techniques and choice of ingredients, but the recipes all have humble origins. Comfort comes in the tingling mala, or numbing spice, of Sichuanese mapo tofu, the nuance of northern steamed dumplings, the caramelized richness of Taiwanese braised beef noodle soup. It isn't high cuisine. It is Chinese food for the soul. So that's from the introduction. And just to kind of tell a little bit of the story of what happened to me once I left the Seattle PI, because I sort of fell off the face of the culinary landscape in Seattle and went dark, so to speak, and you know, did a few other types of work and then suddenly surfaced again in cooking classes. So people were just wondering, what happened to you? Where did you go? I didn't go anywhere. I just was doing other work. And while I was working at the Institute for Systems Biology, I was there for 6 years, and over the last couple of years, that's when I decided that I needed to write this book. And so I worked full-time and wrote the book in the evenings and on weekends and hid away in a quiet part of our house just to do the writing. Spent probably about a year writing recipes and testing them, photographing, et cetera. So it was a long process, but it was fun. I think what I'll do now is I have this, what I think is a kind of a fun essay that I wrote for the Powell's Books blog. They wanted, they said, hey, you can write an essay for the blog and we'll promote your book. I said, okay, what should I write about? And they said, you can write about anything you want, which you should never tell a writer, write about anything you want. So I thought, okay, I thought about it and thought about it, and there's a really funny story about how some of the book came together that I thought I would share. A cookbook is born. A good friend who recently completed her first manuscript ascribed the writing process to giving birth through her face. I choked from laughter at this image and then settled into an empathetic nod. Writing a book, especially an inaugural work, does usher in all the excitement of being an expectant parent in the early stages of gestation. Eventually, the novelty dissolves into the reality of putting the first 10,000 words on the page, and then the next 10,000 words, and the next. A high-voltage prod zapping you if you relent before deadline. My cookbook's birth story could have been an episode of Cutthroat Kitchen on the Food Network, where competitors pay for the right to sabotage an opponent by taking away an essential cooking tool like a proper chef's knife or stove. The inadvertent saboteur in my case was my husband, Eric, who, let's be clear, would never purposely or maliciously pitch me a curveball, but ended up dealing me a serious handicap. I was about 3 months into writing Chinese Soul Food when Eric decided it was an ideal time to refinance at our home. This was not a problem, but my husband is a devotee of HGTV and the DIY network. He had been scheming and wanted to use the refinancing to kickstart what had been our someday kitchen remodel. "You want to remodel the kitchen now?" I asked. "While I'm writing a cookbook?" Yes, Eric said. He rattled off his plan to build my dream kitchen and promised that the work would be completed before Thanksgiving, which would give me 2 months in a new kitchen before my book was due. It was early summer. The refinancing was still in progress. The project scope and contractor still had to be determined. The scheduling had to be confirmed. But my husband had that earnest, faraway look that he gets when visions of demo day and the big reveal start dancing in his head. Of course I wanted a new kitchen. Of course it would increase our property value. Of course, and inevitably, the project would start late, run into delays and personnel drama, go over budget, and push into Christmas. I had front-loaded as much of the recipe testing as I could and left the storytelling and head note writing for when my kitchen would be out of service. But with the delays and a looming deadline, I had to get back into the kitchen. I used a baking sheet and a bar stool to hold my tabletop butane stove, a footstool to hold a tray of seasonings, and a step stool to hold sundry other items. When I needed to stir fry, I would crack open the door, fire up the stove, and test whatever recipes needed to be tested. It was not ideal, but like on Cutthroat Kitchen, I had to prove my mettle as an experienced, resourceful cook who can adapt to almost any kitchen situation and still turn out great food. I talk about this trait in my cookbook, recounting how my parents, after immigrating from Taiwan, were able to make sumptuous Chinese meals for our family, even though they had a tiny kitchen, secondhand pans, no wok, and a few authentic Chinese ingredients. Having to use this bar stool stove in a construction zone had started as a pain point for me, but I realized that this, quote, sabotage was just the reminder I needed that not all the people who cook for my book have high-end kitchens. Anyone should be able to cook a complement of my recipes with the tools and ingredients they have at hand. And the bar stool stove worked just fine. The labor was long, and the complications now make for a funny story, but my cookbook now has a life of its own and is ready to meet the world. So that was behind the scenes, and people who followed me on Facebook and Instagram saw some of the construction zone, and we laugh about it now. But yeah, it was a little nerve-wracking when we didn't have a kitchen, and I couldn't test recipes. So all my friends, thankfully, they're like, "Oh, come borrow my kitchen," because they knew that they would get to eat whatever I made. So I had a few of those requests, a few of those offers. All right, so typically around this time in the event, they open it up for Q&A. So I'm going to let you choose your adventure. I could read one more selection, or we can move on to some questions and just have a conversation, which might be more fun and interesting. Anybody want to ask a question? Yes. So the question is whether you can substitute, instead of using cornstarch, if you can use arrowroot, and sure, you can. Yeah, it would be fine, because really it's not so much for flavor. What I do with that is just a little bit of cornstarch for marinating the meat, and what that helps to do is when you're making the sauce, it helps to thicken the sauce a little bit. The beef? Yeah, that's fine. Totally fine, yes. Sure. Yes, sir. So the question is what some of the flavors are for some of the sauces. So for soy sauce, it's made from soybeans, and if you get, when you're buying soy sauce, you should buy soy sauce that is naturally fermented and brewed. So when you buy, go to the store, look for that on the label. And if you see something that says hydrolyzed soy protein, don't buy that. It's not going to kill you. It's not the end of the world if you buy that or if that's what you have. And as a note, I never want any lack of an ingredient or lack of piece of equipment be a barrier. But if you do have the opportunity to shop at an Asian market, do kind of look for, if you're cooking Chinese food, look for a Chinese soy sauce and then look for naturally fermented to brewed. So the process is quite long, and it varies depending on the maker of the soy sauce. But yes, they cook the soybeans down, and they do let that ferment, and that creates a lot of the flavors. And if you ever come to one of my cooking classes, I actually have a soy sauce tasting bar that I set up, and you can taste through and just see how different they taste. Most people have done wine tastings or olive oil tastings, cheese tastings, etc., and nobody ever gets to taste the different soy sauces. So that's something, they do have a lot of different flavor profiles. And in the book I have a little bit of, I touched just a little bit on some of the research that has been done and all of the flavor-giving attributes. They've identified dozens of those flavor-giving attributes. And it's just like with cheese or with wines, wherever the soybeans are grown, wherever the soy sauce maker is, the fermentation process adds that special something to the flavor of the soy sauce. So it'll say on the label, naturally fermented and naturally brewed, so that's a good indicator. And everybody's familiar with Kikkoman soy sauce because that is the most common, and it's a Japanese brand, which if that's what you have, don't let that stop you from making this food. But like I said, if you do have the opportunity to go shopping, look for something that, and it'll say whether it's made in China or made in Taiwan, that's a good indicator. So read the fine print. And yes, sometimes the labels will have only Chinese on it but usually there's a sticker on the back that has in very tiny print the Chinese. But that's the key indicator, because the bottles don't typically list the flavor profiles on it, so it would be hard to tell just based on the bottle. There are different, I don't want to call them pressings, but like there's just the regular soy sauce. There is soy sauce paste, so it's thicker. The dark soy sauces, those are used typically for braising. But for like a multi-purpose one, there's a section in the book where I talk about, give you some tips on which brands that you could try that would be good for multi-purpose kind of use. Back there. So the question is, how did I decide to get back into the food community, and why did I decide on teaching at this particular school? Is that kind of the gist of the question, or what were the options I was looking at? So I don't know that I had a specific plan for that. I had been working in science for a long time, and I still had all of my friends and colleagues in the food world, and I could see what they were doing. But I just, once you kind of exit that world, you are pulled off of mailing lists, and you don't get invited to all the foodie events and the restaurant openings and such. So I felt like I needed that distance, because when you're in it all the time, you just sort of, you get tunnel vision and you don't have any perspective. So it was good to have that break. And as far as getting back into the food community, the opportunity to teach at Hot Stove was, I thought it was going to be like a one-time thing or maybe two-time thing. And because I at the time, the director, she still is a friend, but she was the director at the time, and she said, hey, it'd be great. It was just a conversation. It would be great if you could come and teach a class on dumplings. And I said, sure, why not? I posted that class, or they posted that class. It sold out in 24 hours. And I thought, oh, okay, what's going on here? Maybe I need to offer another class. So they posted a second one, and that also sold out very fast. And so that was a clue to me that there was a hunger, so to speak, for dumplings, pot stickers, and maybe specifically a class from me. Because I still, you know, I had a lot of readers from my days at the PI, and so every once in a while I'll run into somebody who remembers me from those days, and they'll you know, wax poetic about, oh, I miss your column. I'm like, well, they shut down the paper, so you know, I can't really do anything about that. And as far as looking at other cooking schools, you know, it's working full time. It makes it hard to spread myself that thin. So I kind of have selected one place as a home. Doesn't mean that I haven't committed to being exclusive to Hot Stove, but it's such an amazing venue. If you've ever been there, it's a great place to do hands-on classes. And I've been teaching there for over 3 years now. So, and pot stickers, still, hot seller. They sell out faster than any other class. I don't know if that really answered your question, but, you know. Yes, ma'am. So the question is, why don't the green beans taste as good as they do in a restaurant? That's true for many dishes. When you're in the restaurant, the wok stove is so hot that you cook food in seconds. And if you're not careful, you'll burn it in seconds. That high heat with the carbon steel wok gives it, you know, that je ne sais quoi quality to the food. And that is really challenging to produce at home in a Western kitchen. If you're in Asia, where wok cooking is just a part of life, hot stoves are just, they install that in your home. So it's just a different culture. But to mitigate that, you know, make sure that you have the right pan, the right wok for your stove. So if you have a flat top stove, get a flat bottom wok. If you're trying to cook on using a round bottom wok on a flat stove, you're not going to get that heat concentration. And you also want to preheat your wok too. I found that the little tabletop butane burners actually give off pretty good heat. When we go visit my in-laws, you know, they always want me to make green beans, and I bring my stove because they have a electric stove, and I have a round bottom wok. It's not going to work, so I just bring the stove and cook outside, and it gives off pretty good heat. So you just have to don't overcrowd your pan, preheat your pan, and that will get you a little bit closer to that. Well, you have to determine how much ginger you actually will actively use. So if you know you're not going to use a whole lot, then don't buy a whole lot, right? So especially if you shop in the Asian market, it's totally okay to flip through the pile and find just the right size or just break off the smaller piece. Because I use ginger frequently, I tend to just store it on the counter, but some people store it in the refrigerator. So just buy the right size. Buy it as fresh as you can. Don't buy the super wrinkly one, and then you can store it in the fridge. Oh, like does the thickness affect the quality of the ginger? I don't know that I've noticed a flavor difference. Sometimes ginger can be more fibrous than others, so it's, you know, that's just the variety and the grower, and you can't always tell just by looking at it. I just always want to look for the freshest piece of ginger that I can find so that the skin on the outside is really bright and not wrinkled. You know, that will help. I mean, the skin itself, it is a root, so it's like, it's got some roughness on it, but where it is smooth, make sure that it's really smooth, and that means it's still moist on the inside. Yeah. What's it like teaching cooking? It's a privilege to teach cooking because I just want more people to cook. It's so easy to order out these days. You pull up an app and people deliver food to you very fast and you can get anything you want. And people don't have time, they're overworked, and so they don't cook anymore. And that's sad to me. So for me, the more I can get people into the kitchen, the better. because and I'm not talking about fancy food either. I mean, most of the food I make is pretty straightforward and simple. I work, have kids. They don't want to wait, so I have to cook fast. So it's really fun to be in front of the room and at Hot Stove because the kitchen counters are super tall. They actually built a stage for me. So there's a platform that kind of looks like this box, except it's bigger. And I every time they introduce me, I run up on stage, and then I get to talk to people and help answer questions about dumplings or stir fries and things like that. And then they get to cook, and then I walk around and help them cook. And it's just fun to talk to people and get them cooking. For family, for my family, because my children have completely opposite eating eccentricities. So what I like to do is I will make several stir fries. So instead of, say, stir-fried chicken with baby bok choy, I will make stir-fried bok choy and stir-fried chicken. And then the grown-ups can mix them together, and then my son can eat the bok choy, my daughter can eat just the chicken. So it is my strategy for getting, you know, not being the short order to cook, but at the same time appeasing everybody's desires. So for like an everyday meal, yeah, two or three quick stir fries is, you know, that's the go-to because you can accomplish that pretty simply. I love any of the stir-fried vegetables. There's a wok-seared corn recipe in the book that is so simple. You won't believe how fast you can cook that. And the greens, simple stir-fried greens, you can do that in just a few minutes and sub any vegetable in there that you want. So whether that is an Asian green or kale, you know, you can do that. Maybe a soup, like the egg drop soup with tomato egg drop soup with spinach. Super easy to make. You don't even need broth. It's just water. Keep it pretty simple. Sorry, back here. Okay, largest wok size, like what's an ideal wok size for a home cook? Probably a 12 to 14 inch wok. I have several sizes, but I think 14 inch, if you have a family, is a good size. If you are cooking for, you know, two, a 12 inch wok should be fine. And it just depends on the type of, like if you plan on doing a lot of entertaining, then maybe err on the 14 inch. If you go 16 inches, it's a little too big. Like, I have one, and I rarely use it. It's just too big. Can you heat it up enough? So that, again, will depend on what kind of stove you have. So if you have, if you have a flat top stove, get a flat bottom wok. That's the key. And then if you do have gas, you can try the round bottom, as long as you have the right attachments and stuff. Yes, ma'am. Personally, so I have both. I love the cleaver for its utilitarian, you know, you can use it as a scraper as well, so that makes it very convenient, and you can chop bones, etc. But I have small hands, so I tend to use a chef's knife, and I also tend to use a Japanese chef's knife because they're lighter, yeah. And sometimes a santoku knife because they're shorter. The blade is shorter. So that's just a personal preference. But definitely the cleaver is a lot more utilitarian. And, I have a very inexpensive one. And, yeah, totally fine. Those, the Chinese don't put the same kind of value on the cooking equipment. Like, And what I mean by that is we're not spending $150 on an all-clad pan to make our food. The wok, if you spend more than $35, you've spent too much. Cleaver, if you spent more than $20, you've spent too much. Like, we don't, that's not where we place the value, you know. So don't use the kind of that Western perspective, the European perspective, where you're spending so much on your cast iron and the brand name. Not that those are all good products, don't get me wrong. But it's not necessary. Like, you don't need to. I've had students come in with their very expensive stainless steel all-clad or, you know, one of those woks, and I'm like, sorry, but it's really hard to cook out of that, and you spent a lot of money on it. Whereas this $20 wok would have been just fine. So, yeah, that cleaver sounds great. How are we doing? Is there one more? Oh, we have some other kid questions. Mirabelle. Do I ever get embarrassed by my kids when I'm cooking in public? Do I get embarrassed by my kids when I'm cooking in public? No, my children are angels. I don't get embarrassed by them. No, they get the hairy eyeball if they approach anything near embarrassing. So no. Up here, yes, sir. Are you trying to serve everything all at once? Or are you actually coursing it out? Right. You know, what I try to do is balance the menu selection so that I will have something, say, soupy or something that's braised, so that can just cook while you're doing the a la minute stuff, so the fast stir-fry dishes. Because if you have, say, a braised dish that's already done and it can just hold, and then you balance that out with two or three really fast stir fries. If everything is prepped, it really just takes a couple minutes on each dish, and then you can sit down with your friends and family. But if you pick everything that requires a lot of labor and a lot of last minute, then yeah, you'll never be able to sit down. So what I try to do is just make sure there's something that can just sit on the stove and not, you know, can hold, and then pick a couple of really fast dishes to do. So just kind of balance it that way. Question is, since Chinese New Year is this week, what simple dishes could a novice cook do? The stir-fried noodles with shrimp is a good one, because that is, noodles are for longevity at New Year, so the noodle dish would be a good one. And then maybe the steamed fish, because, you know, as long as you rely on your fishmonger to get a really fresh fish, you can put that in the steamer, and there's not a ton of technique there that you could do. So and fish is good luck and good fortune, lots of prosperity. And then a stir-fried greens, because greens are also good. So, all right, how are we doing? Oh, one last question. Working in science, did that change the way that I cooked? Working in science changed the way that I think, for sure. And I worked in a research facility where, you know, it's all about systems thinking. And the basic principle is that everything is interconnected. Everybody is interconnected. And if you think about that just in a global, you know, philosophical sense, it's pretty profound. Nothing happens in a vacuum. And so from that perspective, it's like, all right, if I'm going to be a part of this world, a part of this community, how do I continue that connectivity? And whether that's through food, through books, through writing, you have to write and present this information in a way that is inclusive and not exclusive. So science helped me do that. Thank you for asking that question. That was awesome. I thank you guys so much for coming. I'm happy to sign your books if you have them. And
this podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.